This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww.
The first half of this episode contains explicit discussions of suicide. If you're having thoughts of suicide or are worried about someone else, please consider Talk Suicide Canada, a free 24/7 hotline. The number is 1-833-456-4566, or you can text 45645 from 4 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. Link in the show notes. Oh! Is this the new Twitter? They just mail you the tweets now because all the programmers were fired or quit? Oh, it's you.
Jonathan, bad news.
Yeah, past experience has taught me that this is going to be more trivial than your tone suggests.
Look, I'm worried our next episode isn't going to be funny enough.
Should I ask you why you're wearing your bathing suit, or is that unrelated?
Unrelated. I'm worried it's going to be hard to make jokes about gun control because it's such a serious topic.
As opposed to our usual lighthearted conversations about cancer mortality.
Exactly.
You know, we don't have to make jokes all the time.
And I don't have to bring my teddy bear with me everywhere I go. What's your point?
Apparently, I don't really have one. Teddy?
Anyway, this might be our first deliberately unfunny episode.
It's okay. With Twitter slowly coming apart of the scenes, we probably won't get many complaints on social media. Except, oh... Do you think people know where I live?
Why?
Let's look out the window. Just as I suspected, they're already using smoke signals.
What does it say?
It says, not funny, unsubscribed. Oh well, you can't please everyone. Show about medicine.
Now with 20% more teddy bears.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is...
Wait. No, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another edition of The Body of Evidence. Today, we are tackling a listener question that was sent to us a little while ago. Sorry it took us so long to get to it, but it took a while to fit this into our schedule and to research it properly because it's a bit outside of our usual wheelhouse.
Pushing yourself out of your comfort zone is important for personal growth.
Says the man who's had the same haircut his entire life.
You also don't mess with success.
The word success was as far from my lips as is possible. That voice you just heard is that of my co-host, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and man whose biography will be titled The Usual, Please.
And that constant voice of criticism is that of Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man who is surprisingly adept at interpreting smoke signals from his living room window.
Anyway, the suggestion for this episode came from Deb, and her question was... What about a possible future topic for the show on guns as a public health problem? I'm sure, like a lot of other countries, Canada is putting in regulation about weapons, so how well does it work and what does the evidence say?
Which is an interesting question because you don't often think about it in that way.
Right, because when we talk about gun control, the question is always political. And in the United States, constitutional. We always talk about whether we should implement gun control, but never really talk about examining individual policies in a critical or evidence-based way.
Right, because presumably not everything is going to be equally effective. Some strategies might work better than others, and identifying what works and what doesn't is pretty important to any public health response.
So this episode is not going to be a conversation about whether gun control measures should be implemented because of recent school shootings and all that.
No.
We're just going to assume that our listeners don't want children to die if it can be avoided.
Right? I mean, can you imagine how terrible it would be if people saw a public health disaster brewing in children and did nothing to prevent it?
Okay, that's our first and last veiled reference to the nightmarish situation unfolding in pediatric hospitals. So anyway, on with the topic for today. First off, we have to define what outcome we are interested in.
Right, because there are multiple different possible outcomes we might be interested in. We might want to implement measures to reduce gun crime, or to reduce deaths from firearms, or mass shootings, or shootings involving the police, or the impact on gun sales, or how a policy affects recreational hunting.
Recreational hunting? Why would that matter?
Well, it may not matter to you specifically, but any policy has unintended consequences, and some people enjoy hunting as a sport. So when you pass any policy, you have to be very specific as to what outcome you want to look at and whether you want to look at multiple outcomes simultaneously.
Okay, so let's start with what I at least think is the most important outcome, which is gun deaths, because I want fewer people to die if it can be avoided.
You are a prince among men, sir. So let's start there. Firearms deaths. And just a quick note, we are recording here in Canada, but as with so many other things, we often look at U.S. data and statistics because, frankly, U.S. data is sometimes just more readily available to us. So, notwithstanding the differences between our two countries, we are going to be looking at various sources to inform our understanding of the subject, but we will be telling you where specific pieces of data come from, and we'll have our references in our show notes as we usually do.
Okay, so let's first understand the scope of the problem. How big of a problem is firearm-related deaths?
So if we take data from the American Public Health Association and the CDC, the Centers of Disease Control and Protection, there were 45,222 firearm deaths in the U.S. in 2020. That is 13.7 deaths per 100,000 people. That is slightly more than the number of people who died in traffic accidents, which is 40,698.
Okay, and what about other countries?
So when you look at the U.S. in comparison to other high-income countries like Australia, France, Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom, if you look at all the firearm deaths in all of those countries, the majority, and I mean the vast majority, 82%, occur in the United States.
Wow. Okay, so that's a big imbalance.
Absolutely.
And this is driven by violent crime in the U.S.?
So actually, no. And this might be the first thing that surprises you on this subject, because most firearm deaths are suicides. Over half of firearm deaths in the U.S., 60%, are suicides.
Wow. Okay, so that puts a very different complexion on the problem.
Yeah, now, mass shootings are obviously a problem, and you know we need to stop those from happening, obviously. The correct number of mass shooting events in schools that we should aim for is zero.
That goes without saying. We have to say it. I forgot. No mass shootings in schools. Oh, my chest hurts.
Do you want Teddy?
Yes.
Here you go. So that's, I think, surprising to most people, because while mass shootings make up about 1% of firearm deaths, suicides make up the majority of gun-related deaths. And if your goal is to prevent death...
Yeah, and it is, because we're not Bond villains.
Right, then addressing the really, really complex topic of suicide is where you have to aim the majority of your efforts.
So does firearm legislation have any role to play in this situation then? I mean, I'm almost shocked to hear myself say this, but should the focus then be, not exclusively, but importantly, on medical care for mental illness and for suicide prevention rather than on gun legislation? I mean, I don't personally feel comfortable attributing all suicides to mental illness. I think there's a deep philosophical discussion to be had about what we do with our lives and about dignity and state of mind and medical assistance in dying, which we might discuss in an upcoming episode. But if 60% of firearms-related deaths have to do with suicide, shouldn't more effort be put into addressing that? Why is there this squeezing pain in my chest when I say these things?
Right, so that's an understandable conclusion to draw, until you consider the following. Suicide attempts with a gun result in death about 85% of the time. But other methods, like drug overdoses, only result in death 3% of the time.
Oh, wow. That is different, but I don't really see why that would...
Well, because the reality is that nearly 90% of the people who survive a suicide attempt will not ultimately die by suicide. In fact, 70% will not even attempt suicide a second time. So removing the lethality of a suicide attempt, well, it gives people that second chance. Essentially, the presence of a gun transforms a suicide attempt from an impulsive action into a fatal one.
So removing access to firearms is going to make suicide attempts less likely to be fatal, and then logically people who survive can get the help they might need?
Right, because suicide attempts are often regretted afterwards. That's what interviews with suicide survivors have often shown. Because when people attempt suicide, it's often because they feel like no one cares. And if they can survive and get help afterwards, that discredits that perception. So obviously, yes, you need more support for mental health. And if you want to prevent firearm deaths, of which suicides are the main part, then denying people access to firearms will reduce those deaths. It won't just displace them to another mechanism, as some people like to claim.
Yeah, I mean, we do hear that claim a lot. Okay, so this is a heavy topic, so we're going to take a break.
Yeah, I need to hug Teddy a little bit.
He's hugging me now. All right, he's with me now. So anyway, when we come back, we're going to look at other aspects of gun control research and explain one of the main problems that this branch of research faces. Step into our audio-only time machine and revisit past episodes of the podcast. Here's a clip from episode 63 on stomach ulcers.
So no, not really, because nothing you eat is going to be more acidic than the acid that is already in your stomach. So pouring some spicy spaghetti sauce into the cauldron of super concentrated acid that is your stomach won't do very much.
All of our episodes are available at bodyofevidence.ca and wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome back to our episode on gun control, a topic where yelling inflammatory things is, surprisingly enough, not helpful.
Perhaps we should invoke historical precedents that are not directly relevant to the current situation.
That, too, is unlikely to help. What would help is high-quality data so that we can assess, you know, where the problem is, who is at risk, and what programs or policies are the most effective at making things better.
That would be the sensible approach to the problem.
Right. So now we talked about the situation in the U.S., but just briefly, is it similar in Canada?
Yes, it is. About 80% of firearm deaths in Canada are suicides. Interestingly, whereas they tend to be handguns in the U.S., in Canada, suicides tend to be committed with long guns. So just a reminder that data is not necessarily superimposable from one country to another. Regional variations can be important in understanding the problem.
Yeah, that's going to make wrapping our heads around this problem more difficult, given that we here in Canada tend to default to American data for the reasons we mentioned at the outset. It's often more easily available. Let's talk briefly about violent crime, though, because while I now realize that the conversation around gun deaths is tied with a really complicated conversation around suicide, the issue of violent crime and of firearm-related homicides is still something people worry about a lot. And a common worry is that violent crime, especially gun crime, is going up around the world.
So, disconcertingly, it is, at least here in Canada, at least a little bit. Gun crime and violent crime overall was actually going down in Canada during most of the early 2000s. However, starting in 2014, gun crime started going up. Although the numbers were stable between 2019 and 2020, and they still represent a very small percentage of violent crime here in Canada, under 3% of all violent offenses.
So are accidental deaths not a major component of gun-related deaths?
Not really from the data. Remember, the U.S. has around 40,000 gun-related deaths every year. Over half of those are suicides, but only around 500 of those 40,000 deaths are accidental or unintentional firearm injuries.
All right. So the question becomes then, what do we do about the problem? How do we address it?
So a useful paradigm would be to think about road traffic safety. Many of the same issues regarding road traffic accidents have been discussed with regard to gun control. So first, you need to study motor vehicle crashes to see what works. Then you can regulate the industry to demand certain changes in car safety, like seatbelts, airbags. And then you can implement driver's licenses, car registrations, and require that those be renewed annually or whatever interval you choose. And you can prohibit risky people from driving cars.
Like people who drink and drive.
Exactly. And you can set manufacturing standards on vehicles, put age requirements on who can drive a car, and you can establish rules for liability and have recalls if there's something wrong or dangerous about specific car models.
I see. So you can do the same thing with the gun industry. Regulate the industry, require a gun license, weapon registration, you know, stop people with criminal records from buying guns, set a minimum age for who can own a gun, all of that.
Yeah, that's the point.
Okay, cool. So what's the problem?
So the counter argument is that there's no good evidence that any of these things curb gun violence.
I see. Well, that's why we need skepticism. I mean, I keep tearing up my skeptic's card and taping it back together, but aspiring to scientific skepticism is important. I demand proof. So if there's no proof that any of this works, then we shouldn't bother with any of these measures, because clearly every public health agency out there, like the CDC, the AMA, the APA, the APHA, is just plain wrong, and I'm the only one smart enough to see it. Damn it. I just pulled the Prasad.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's like Smeagol turning into Gollum. Now, wait a minute. Why is there no good evidence about any of these public health measures?
Well,
is this going to be depressing?
A bit. I'll get the bear.
Just tell me.
Well, see, the thing is that for a long time, the gun lobby in the U.S. actually got Congress to specifically mandate that the CDC couldn't research gun violence and federal funds couldn't be used for that purpose.
They must have had a healthy budget for mustache wax, given the amount of facial hair twirling on display here.
Unclear, but basically, in 1996, they passed the Dickey Amendment.
Apt name.
It is. So, in 1992, the CDC converted its division on violence prevention into a program to reduce deaths and injuries resulting from violence.
I can't imagine why anyone would oppose such a thing unless you profited from the sale of products that were used to harm others. Oh.
Right. So the National Rifle Association, or NRA, started getting worried about this body of research that was linking gun ownership with homicides.
Predictable.
So the NRA convinced Representative Jay Dickey of Arkansas to lead a push to pass an amendment to the 1996 spending bill in Congress that said that federal funds could not be used to advocate for or promote gun control.
But that wouldn't preclude funding research.
Not necessarily, no. But the language of the amendment, which, by the way, was included every year in every spending bill, was so vague that nobody wanted to pick a fight with the NRA.
So basically, all research into gun violence stopped.
Bingo. And the budget previously allocated to research on gun violence went to traumatic brain injury research instead. Now, things changed in 2018 after the Parkland shooting in Florida. Congress needed to pass an emergency spending bill to prevent a shutdown, and part of the compromise was a softening of the Dickey Amendment, which, by the way, even Jay Dickey himself had sort of turned against by the end. And so the compromise was that the amendment was still in place, and you couldn't use federal funds to advocate for gun control, but federal money could still fund research into the issue of gun violence. So at least that happened.
But that still means that there was, you know, like 30 years where nothing was done in terms of researching and looking into this issue.
Sadly, yes. So the research base is very, very limited. Now, there was a large review done by the RAND Corporation.
Oh, from Iron Fist?
No, that's RAND Enterprises. The RAND Corporation is a real-life think tank, mainly funded by the U.S. military, but they do non-military stuff too.
I'm genuinely curious to hear what a think tank funded by the U.S. military thinks about gun violence. Putting the tank in think tank, proceed.
Right, so they started their Gun Policy in America initiative to address the obvious issue of not enough data to really be sure what worked and what didn't in terms of gun control legislation. So they did a big review of the field and graded the quality of research for all the different possible outcomes of gun violence.
Kind of like what the Cochrane Collaboration does for medical research.
Yeah, good analogy. So anyway, they reviewed the data and they have some really good graphs and tables summarizing all their findings, which is quite fascinating.
You are very impressed by graphs. That is true. Netflix could greenlight a graph-based TV show, and you would shell out for an annual subscription.
I would, actually, yes. So they evaluated these various outcomes to see what impact did intervention X have on suicide, violent crime, unintentional gun deaths, officer-involved shootings, mass shooting episodes, defensive gun use, hunting and recreation, or gun industry outcomes.
Because intervention X having an impact on suicides wouldn't necessarily have an impact on mass shootings, for example.
Exactly. And they evaluated 18 different policies like minimum age requirements, background checks, assault weapon bans, waiting periods, concealed carry laws, and stuff like that.
And I'm worried you're going to say that the findings are inconclusive.
Well, so they categorized everything as no evidence if there were no studies on the subject, inconclusive if the research was inconsistent, limited if there was only one study in support of the measure, moderate if there were two studies of good quality, and supportive if there were at least three studies of good quality.
And I'm assuming there was no evidence for most things because the NRA quashed research on this issue.
Right. And funnily enough, most of the things people talk about when we discuss gun laws, fatal shootings involving the police, defensive gun use, use of guns for hunting, there's virtually no evidence. For mass shootings, what evidence exists is inconclusive. Even something that you would think should be self-evident, like minimum age requirements, has either no or inconclusive evidence behind it. There's limited evidence that reduces suicides, but that's it.
And that dearth of data is made possible because, of course...
Well, again, lack of funding for research. But also, you have to realize that any laws that affect the purchase of new firearms are not going to have any impact on things like gun crime or people's ability to hunt, because those are likely done with existing firearms, so guns people already have in their possession.
But they will have an impact eventually. I mean, if you implement them, and assuming they work, obviously, they will have an impact with time.
Yes, but that's hard to prove in a research project. Small effects that manifest over long term are hard to prove statistically. So if we want to know if things work or not, you need rigorous and long-term studies to do that.
Worth pointing out that even small changes in firearm-related deaths or injuries have a huge impact on the population as a whole, given the scope of a problem, especially in the United States. Small risks and small benefits translate into big numbers in the absolute sense when applied to a whole population.
Agreed.
But is there good evidence for anything then, or is this going to be one more of the unsatisfying interactions I have with you on a regular basis?
It can be both. And look, despite the many shortcomings and lacunae in the data, there are two things that do have an impact. Child access prevention laws, sometimes called CAP, CAP, and stand your ground laws.
So a child access prevention law is different from a minimum age requirement?
Yes. A minimum age requirement just says you need to be over 18 or however old to buy a gun. Those have limited evidence that they prevent suicide and inconclusive evidence for outcomes on other stuff.
Presumably because teenagers might have access to guns that are already in the house.
Yeah, maybe. It's a little bit equivocal. But a CAP law, a child access prevention law, is a law that makes it illegal to store a gun in an unsafe manner where a child can access it.
Ah, I see. So legislating common sense. So those work?
Yes, if we can be definitive about anything in this crazy messed up world of ours, then we can be pretty certain about that. CAP laws reduce suicides and unintentional gun deaths. Limited evidence about whether they have an impact on violent crime.
And the second intervention with good data behind it?
Stand your ground laws.
You're in favor of stand your ground laws? Where you don't have to retreat in the face of danger? You're allowed to simply use deadly force?
No. The evidence is that they make things worse.
Ah.
There's supportive evidence that they increase violent crime.
That makes more sense. We should probably just briefly explain what those laws mean because they're frequently confused with self-defense laws. As I hinted at, a stand-your-ground law means you can use deadly force if you are attacked and you have no duty to retreat. Duty to retreat, meanwhile, signifies that if you could reasonably escape a situation, then you should do so and avoid using deadly force. Stand-your-ground means you have no duty to retreat and can use deadly force even if you had other options. Anyway, we won't get into the legal minutia here because there's a lot of variability from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and home invasions fall under a different category. And the point is that these types of laws, the details of which are different in different places, they increase violent crime.
Yes, although their effect on suicides or mass shootings is inconclusive.
Well, this has been a fascinating, scary, and confusing story in equal measure.
That's how I feel about the social media platform Mastodon. It's like Twitter if you're doing LSD.
That is a different conversation. But I think that the thing that troubles me the most is that we've had 30 years of stagnation on this issue, at least in the U.S., because of a moratorium on research funding. And we've got to fix that, and quickly, because gun deaths are preventable.
Yes, and there needs to be money put into that.
Money?
Money.
Money, money?
Money, money.
Oh, it's like that song.
Money, money, money. We need money to study gun violence. Money, money, money. Give us money for gun control science.
When we come back, recreational cannabis has been legal in Canada since October 2018. Our country has not turned into a haze-filled zombie land of perpetually hungry dope heads, but something bad has been increasing and we should pay attention. That's after the break. Step into our audio-only time machine and revisit past episodes of the podcast. Here is a clip from our conversation with Brennan McKenzie on pets.
It seems obvious if you imagine in your mind a herd of pugs or Welsh corgis taking down and savaging an elk or something like that. It's pretty hard to imagine.
I think they just lack the proper motivation.
All of our episodes are available at bodyofevidence.ca and wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to the Body of Evidence. Cannabis, a.k.a. marijuana, a.k.a. pot. You don't have to smoke it. I am told you can eat it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, so can children. A study out of Ontario reports that we are seeing an increase in the hospitalization of children for unintentional cannabis poisoning. So what does cannabis poisoning look like in a child?
Well, when the children come into the emergency room, they are super chill. Like, they are just...
A lot of parents are paying attention all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Wait, this is the way to do this? Yeah.
So we're joking, but there have been cases of parents telling their kids to inhale marijuana smoke to make them like sleepy to put them to bed.
I see.
So it's an upgrade from the full, you know, give Benadryl to your kids.
Right.
I had a professor when I was in medical school who would tell us openly that she would give cough syrup to her kids before long drives to like put them to sleep in the car.
Interesting.
And I'm like, I'm not saying that people haven't done that, but maybe don't admit to it publicly.
Yeah.
So this entire conversation predicate on the idea, don't give marijuana to children. It's not good. Actually, some evidence that even very high doses can actually damage a developing brain. There have been studies that. Again, this is with recreational use and high doses in young kids, but still, like, you know, they're children. Don't give them marijuana. Don't give them alcohol. Alcohol also very dangerous for children. So
there are specific uses for example, CBD, cannabidiol for children with refractory epilepsy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's not a miracle plant, despite what you might have seen on the internet.
No, and the point is that the doses that are fine for adults are not fine for kids, which again is also true for alcohol and coffee and everything else.
And for Tylenol and Advil, as we're finding, as parents are finding out these days when they go to the pharmacy and the children's dosages are no longer available.
So children can overdose on regular doses of marijuana and they can, you know, need to be hospitalized. I mean, it is rare. It depends on the dose. So the more they consume, the more likely they are to need to be hospitalized.
But what are the symptoms?
So the symptoms are usually like, so it's interesting that they can go in either directions. They can also, they can have sleepiness or they can have euphoria and irritability. So they can have and this is true of marijuana in general, right? Most, well, I shouldn't say most, but a fair number of people you know, when they take marijuana, it's a suppressant, right? They're calm, they're more lenient. But some people become anxious, right? A lot of people develop anxiety on marijuana.
And there are different strains also, and, you know, so it can be...
It depends on the person, it depends on the dose. But so that's the thing. So you can have sleepiness and irritability and anywhere on the thing, and then it can also cause, like, nausea and vomiting and slurred speech, and, you know, you can also get dilated pupils in children as well. So there are... situations where it is like it can affect your vital signs, and in very, very rare circumstances there have been seizures as well. So it can be very serious depending on the dose. Sometimes you just need to be observed in the emergency room, sometimes you need to be admitted, and there have been cases, you know, especially with seizures, where children have had to go to the ICU. So overdoses with marijuana in children are happening, and they are going up, and I think that's the worrisome trend.
Okay, so the study that I hinted at, it used Quebec as a control province because they stated that the sale of cannabis edibles was prohibited in Quebec. However, I'm a little bit confused because you can buy edibles here. And so what exactly happened there?
So when they did the study, you couldn't. You can now. The law changed in April of 2022. The Quebec government allowed the sale of marijuana and of liquid, like CBD oils, but not edibles.
I see.
That changed. And it was, again, I think partly a reflection of this concern, but it created an interesting situation where you could compare what was happening in Ontario, British Columbia, and Alberta, and compare to Quebec, where edibles were not legal. And you could look to see if there was a difference in the trend between, you know, how many children were suffering accidental overdoses.
So what did the researchers find?
There was actually quite a bit of a difference. When you look at the graphs, and it's a very short article, so if anybody wants to, you go to the New England Journal of Medicine, you look it up, you can see the graphs. Basically, when you plotted these different provinces, when marijuana became legal in Alberta and Ontario and BC, the line started going up. And in Quebec, they went up, but like more or less holding steady, it was more stable. So you could clearly see that making marijuana edibles more accessible to people. And let's be realistic, edibles were still available in Quebec. They just weren't legal. You have to get them on the gray market. But the more easily accessible something is, the more you result, the more childhood intoxications you got. And I mean, the fundamental truth of this, I hope, is obvious to people because it applies not just to edibles, but also to detergent pods, right? If you make something accessible to kids and it looks like candy, kids are going to try to eat it because they don't know any better.
This increase in poisonings is, as the authors remark, in spite of the fact that, first of all, there are limits on the potency of these edibles. Many of them are sold in plain, childproof packaging, although you're going to tell me that that's not always the case. So why is this happening, and what can be done to further prevent this, especially given, you know, we should mention the disastrous situation that's happening right now with children's hospitals, which are overflowing with cases because of RSV and influenza. So you do not want your child to have to go to the hospital right now.
Right. I think the big problem is that the law is not actually being enforced. So there was a situation that happened here during Halloween in Winnipeg, Manitoba, here in Canada. And this happened to a friend of mine. Her kids went out trick-or-treating and got edible marijuana as a trick-or-treating gift. You know, in their tote bags.
And not as an accident.
Not as an accident. This appeared to have been a deliberate. There was a couple that was giving out in tote bags, like you know, pre-zipped packages, edibles. And what's worse, the dosage of the edibles was an extremely high dose. Health Canada sets the limit of a dose at 5 to 10 milligrams of THC. These packages had 600 milligrams, so they were huge doses.
Was the couple named Cheech and Chong?
They were not. Their names have actually not been released publicly. But I feel like even Cheech and Chong would have known not to give marijuana to children. Because
perhaps.
But here's the thing, too. The packaging was deliberately made to be a look-alike. So they were they looked a lot like Nerds candies.
I see.
The packaging. And so this is the problem. Even though it's expressly forbidden by law to have this type of it's colorful, but
imitative.
It's like a chameleon pack. Like, it's designed to look like an established brand. And it's a very, very high dose. So there are two things wrong with it, both of which are expressly prohibited by the current legislation. It's just that this black, or they call it the gray market for edibles, exist. And it makes it easier for children to get at it accidentally. Because if you have it at home, adults could be confused. My friend had to look at it twice because on the first pass, it looked like regular candy. And, you know, her kids didn't need it. And apparently none of the kids in the neighborhood did. But, you know, if you weren't paying super, super attention, you could be like, yeah, that's just candy, and not realize that your kids could end up eating it accidentally.
And you saw pushback against this because some people recognized the shape of the story as, oh, it's that thing about people putting razor blades in candy. That's an urban legend. Therefore, that is not true.
Well, so in the lead up to Halloween, there was a lot going on the internet about rainbow fentanyl and a lot of people, quote unquote, debunking the claim. What happened was, for people who weren't following this, the DEA in the U.S. had seized shipments of fentanyl that were apparently like colorful tablets rather than just plain white, and the nickname rainbow fentanyl stuck. And they set a warning to parents, check your kids' Halloween candy just in case there's, you know, fentanyl tablets in there. Now, to be fair, like, how likely was it that drug dealers were going to be putting fentanyl in Halloween candy? Like, there's no economic incentive for them to do that, right?
But at least it was based on a real finding. It was just a little warning, like, hey, just be on the lookout.
What I loved is people are like, this is a hoax. I'm like, well, no, it's not a hoax. It is. Anyways, I thought the whole story was weird. But also, like, you know, when you try to talk about the safety of Halloween candy, yes, let's be fair, it's unlikely that people are going to be putting razor blades in chocolate. Like, most people are not going to do that because there's no benefit to them to do so. But that doesn't preclude some person with no grasp of the reality of the situation to do something potentially dangerous, i.e. like handing out edible marijuana to children. So should you check your kids' Halloween candy? Yeah, it's probably not the worst idea. You should check what kids put in their mouths, just as a general safety thing. So I
parenting this, advice from Chris.
Yeah, exactly. So and this is the thing now. And if you're going to have marijuana in your home, which you, even if you're an adult and you want to do that, fine. It's not the healthiest thing in the world, and I have some issues with the health consequences of marijuana. But be aware, you got to keep it out of the reach of children, because if it looks like candy, kids are going to try to eat it.
When we come back, speaking of overflowing children's hospitals, RSV is a virus that's been in the news lately. What if there was a vaccine against RSV infections? Well, that may soon be a reality. That's after the break.
Do you like medicine that tastes funny and science made easy? Jonathan and I are so much more than disembodied voices on the internet. Join our Facebook community, follow us on Instagram, and check out our website at bodyofevidence.ca to find all of our episodes as well as our science cartoons. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Labos, and Jonathan is at Cracked Science. Let's fight back against misinformation.
Welcome to the final stretch of the Body of Evidence. Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a common virus that causes lower respiratory tract infections. In kids, the first infection can cause an inflammation of some of the lower airways. It can be fatal. In older children and in adults, you can be asymptomatic or have the symptoms of an upper respiratory tract infection. Now, why are we hearing about RSV these days?
Well, there's a lot of it going around. And if you work in a pediatric hospital, it's basically your 2020 right now. I mean, this is kids are getting sick a lot,
right,
all over the place, and the ICUs are overflowing. Here in Montreal, we are doubling up people in ICU rooms. That's the official policy now.
Wow.
So they're like, yeah, we're doing this. And, you know, they're putting the older kids in adult centers. So basically the reverse of what happened at the beginning of the pandemic, where the adults were in the pediatric. So it's not going well. And we'll see what the next few months hold. But yeah, there's a lot of RSV circulating.
And of course, all of that is because of the well-known fact of the immunity debt.
Yeah, I'm amazed that we keep talking about this because it's not really a thing. It's not a concept. Like, I don't. It's weird. It's because on a superficial level, the things that people say are not necessarily wrong, right? If you're immune naive to something, your first infection is going to be bad. The problem that I have with this theory, despite the fact that immunity debt as a concept didn't exist before COVID, it was coined in 2020.
I wrote about this 2021. A French group, they just boldly declared it in an opinion paper that they wrote, and then in the conclusion to the paper, they finally they changed it a little bit. They were like, well, it may be possible. It makes sense to hypothesize this. And now, ever since then, people have been talking about this like it's an established fact. It is not.
Yeah, but the thing that bothers me too, if you're going to make the case that all the kids are getting sick now because they were not exposed to RSV, well, any child older than 3 was exposed to RSV before COVID, right? And any child that's less than 6 months old, we haven't been doing any public health measures for the past 6 months. They're the same that they would have been in a non-COVID world. So why are they getting more sick? Like, that doesn't make sense. Also, we didn't put kids in a sterile bubble. I mean, yes, we shut down schools, but we shut down schools from like March to June of 2020. Schools were operating normally more or less through the fall of 2020.
Some with mask mandates.
Some with mask mandates. And then there was, again, the shutdown when Omicron happened for a few months. But then they sort of continued normally. And, you know, I don't think that what's been going on really disrupted. And here's the other thing. People are talking about like RSV has disappeared. No, there was a spike of RSV cases in 2021. Last summer, coincidentally enough, when we lifted the mask mandates at the time, you know? So I'm like,
shush.
But it's like the narrative doesn't actually fit the reality of the situation.
It feels emotionally true.
Well, yeah.
Also, it's important to point out that the healthcare system has not been doing well, and a lot of people are out sick, and
right.
So that also plays a role.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not just that you're running out of beds, like it's a furniture problem, that you need attending healthcare professionals.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the ICU, like there is extra space in ICUs, you just don't have the nurses to take care of them. I mean, and it's more a nursing problem than a doctor problem, because you can have one doctor take care of 20 patients, mm-hmm. but especially in the ICU, you need one-to-one, maybe one-to-two nursing care. So what limits you more is the amount of available nurses. So that's the other problem. It's like, yeah, the kids are getting sick, but we don't have the capacity to absorb that many patients coming into the healthcare system anymore, because so many people are just off sick, burnt out, quit, left, and they just haven't been replaced.
So pediatricians are very familiar with RSV. Why do we not yet have a vaccine against this virus?
Because previous attempts didn't work. People tried to make RSV vaccines before, and they were unsuccessful. They actually made things worse. There mm-hmm. were sort of like, there was an inflammatory responses and lung damage. And so you have to strike this balance between the immunogenicity of the vaccine and the damage that it causes if you have too robust an immune response. So when they used a live attenuated vaccine, people got sick, and I guess you could draw an analogy to sort of like the live polio vaccines, if you will. Like, some people do get sick when mm-hmm. you have a live virus. Anyway, so all this to say, without getting too far into the weeds, there were attempts. They were just largely unsuccessful up until now, when we actually have some potential good candidates that might be available fairly soon.
Yeah, so Pfizer is now reporting positive results from the phase 3 clinical trial of their RSV vaccine. It is important to mention, it's not the baby that's getting the vaccine.
No, it's the mother, pregnant mothers, second and third trimester pregnant women.
So what are they reporting in terms of results right now?
So we only have the top line results. So why
Meaning?
This? Yeah. So the top line results, basically you get the one line summary. Now, why this is a thing, most people don't know this. It's that when the trial is done, it's not really a secret, because the main researchers know. It has to be released to the company that owns the product, the funding source. So many people need to know the results of this trial that it's actually not really a secret anymore.
It would be difficult to keep it like a conspiracy, is what you're saying.
No, so the reason why this exists is that if you didn't make it public, uh-huh. everybody who was involved in the trial could then go out and buy stock in Pfizer.
Right.
So it's a way to prevent insider trading, because now everybody knows that the study worked. Mm-hmm. Because the people who invest in stocks, they don't care about the nitty gritty details. Right. They just want to know it's positive. I'm going to buy stock.
Exactly. So the downside is that we do not have access to the data yet. We don't have access to the details.
No.
Of what
we just we just know the summary, which mm-hmm. was for the first 90 days of the infant's life. So we mm-hmm. vaccinate the mothers, and we want to see how much protection the baby has. First 3 months of life, 82% protection against infection. And then at 6 months, it was 69%. So some waning of immunity over time, which is what we see, I guess, in most situations. But pretty good, all things considered.
And then there's Moderna also. They're talking about their 3-in-1 vaccine, which is meant to immunize against RSV and influenza and COVID-19, but we haven't seen the data yet.
No, and I mean, they've been talking about this for also the better part of a year. So I don't know if this plan is actually going to go forward or not. It may just become logistically simpler to have them as three separate vaccines. We'll see. I mean, there's the convenience factor of having a 2-in-1, but again, we'll see. I mean, there's been talk about this for some time. It's going to be difficult to, if we have to start staggering the doses for whatever reasons because of, I mean, we assume that all of these viruses are going to have the traditional winter peaks that we usually see. It hasn't necessarily played out that way. So I think there's still some uncertainty about what the optimal rollout strategy is going
to
be.
So what is likely to happen in the coming year with regards to the testing of and the potential approvals of RSV vaccines, and what might the next RSV season look like?
Well, once we see the results of the MATISSE trial, which was the study in pregnant women to protect babies, and then the complement to that, which was the RENOIR trial, which was
sensing
the,
a theme.
Yeah, that's right. RSV vaccine in older individuals. If this is rolled out for 2023, which is the presumed availability date, because you still need to get approval from FDA and Health Canada, potentially it won't be as bad, because if you can take care of those extremes of ages, the very, very young and the very, very old, they are the ones who get the most sick. They won't end up in hospital. They won't end up in ICU. We won't have pediatric ICUs overflowing. I mean, that's obviously going to make the situation more tolerable. And so not dissimilar to what we're seeing with COVID now, at least if you don't have the rush on the hospital system, you can manage the other stuff as you go. So hopefully that works.
Well, thank you for that. And we want to thank all of our lovely listeners who contribute to the show. We want to thank a patron who upped their pledge, Louise O'Neill. We want to thank our newest patrons, Glenn T., Mark Elfield, and Antoine Landry. We want to thank Ian for his regular PayPal contribution. We want to thank all of our patrons, but especially those at the $5 or more level. And they are Alan, Barb, Bill, Brian, Dan, DJA, Don, L, Frank, Jeff, Grace, Isabel, Islan, Jean-Nicolas, Jeff, Joanne, John, Juan, Caitlin, Carrie, Ken, Laura, Leanne, Leon, Leslie, Louise, Luna, Lindsay, Marianne, Mark, Mary, Mavis, Miriam, Ms. Bean, Nolan, Olga, Pascal, Pat, Paul, Rina, Robin, Ronald, Rye, Scott, Sky, That Montreal Guy, and Trimian.
If you can think of a better way for us to name your names, share it with us, because we've been scratching our heads for a solution for a while now.
If you want to help support our show, and you should go to bodyofevidence.ca/about, and you will see two options. You can make a donation through PayPal, or you can become a patron on Patreon, either make the monthly contributions or an annual contribution. When you become a patron for as little as $1 a month, you get access to a patron-only bonus segment each month called Digressions. And this month's digressions will be on...
Why selfies will be the downfall of humanity. You think I'm making a joke, but... Listen, I'm teasing it. I'm teasing it a little bit.
You are.
I'm teasing. So if you log on, you'll see what we're talking about. It's going to be, I think, an interesting discussion.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our jingle was composed and performed by Jillian Correa of the Virtual Music School Rocktavio, Canada. Check the show notes for full music credits. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy. Proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the
body of evidence.
Money, 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 we need money to study gun violence. Money, 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 give us money for gun control science.